Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the BumperSticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. The BumperSticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. The BumperSticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let the BumperSticker.com help you get the word out. That's the BumperSticker.com at the BumperSticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is the great Sheldon Richman. Where did my Sheldon Richman article go? I had it here a second ago. I don't know. Hey, welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Can you hear me all right?
You know what? Your cell phone doesn't sound nearly as good as your old landline did, I'll tell you that.
Hello, is that better?
Yeah, that's quite a bit better anyway.
Good.
All right, good. All right, I'm looking at your piece now. It's called We Must Not Be the World's Policeman by Sheldon Richman. Good use of the term must not there. I like that. That's at fff.org. And, you know, it reminded me actually of a video that I saw of you and Joe Sobrin and I think Pat Buchanan and a couple of others organized to oppose the first Gulf War back in 1990 and what at that time was called Operation Desert Shield. And I believe that I remember you, Sheldon, making the point that, you know, we don't know what might happen here. There could be severe long-term consequences that we might wish we had avoided.
Well, I didn't have a crystal ball. I just thought I had some common sense.
A little bit of economic sense, too, I guess.
Which that whole panel had. Yes, I have fond memories of that. It is online, actually. It's on YouTube somewhere.
Yeah, it was Americans Against a Middle Eastern Holocaust or something like that, right?
Something like that, yes. It was organized by the late Phil Nicolaides.
A couple of million people have been killed in wars since then over there, so America's wars. So...
Yes.
Good choice of the term Holocaust there, too.
Nobody learned the lesson, unfortunately. A few people learned the lesson.
Yeah. Now, take us back to that time, actually, because, you know, I was just in ninth grade, and I was for the government exploding whoever overseas, you know? What a great indulgence when the government is leading the parade of evil, you know? Hooray for, you know, a 14-year-old sociopathic young man like me. you know, for the rest of you who were, you know, grown-ups and thinking... Was there not, especially, it was George Bush Sr., and he was known to me, especially by way of Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live, his catchphrase was to be prudent and to be, you know, careful and responsible and very grown up and whatever. And yet, really, the Americans, they chose at the end of the Cold War, rather than being prudent, they would go ahead and take every opportunity that they had to expand. And it seemed like if people go back and watch that video now, it's you and Pat Buchanan and them. Y'all are the ones saying, hey, let's be prudent. And it's George H.W. Bush is up there beating his chest.
Well, look, George H.W. wanted to be prudent and George W. wanted to be humble. What's Obama want to be? He wants to be the Peace Prize winner.
Yeah.
So there's a bad pattern here. Maybe we need a guy who says, let's be a warmonger, and then when he gets in, he becomes a pacifist. That's what we need to do, I think.
Yeah, it should have been McCain. We'd all be rich and at peace right now.
The other telling thing that George H.W. said in the build-up to that war in 1990-91 was, quote, what we say goes. I'll never forget that quote. That doesn't get quoted very much, but I saw him say that on TV, and so I'll never forget it. He said... This was, you know, his first inclination was not to get involved. He did want to be prudent, but he happened to be at some Aspen event with the late Margaret Thatcher, who said, "Don't go wobbly on us, George." I didn't see this in too many of the obituaries and eulogies about the great, limited government person, Margaret Thatcher. But she said, "Don't go wobbly, George." And from that day, he became gung ho about going into Kuwait and, you know, bombing Iraq. And that's when he said, what we say goes. And that goes with the America as World Policeman take for granted. Now, thank goodness people aren't gung-ho for getting into this. They seem to think this is a bit too much. But I think most people generally think the U.S. is the source of order in the world and needs to be the policeman who, you know, if things get bad enough, has to come to the rescue. And we have to break that mindset.
Well, are you sure it's so wrong? I mean, after all, it's got to be somebody. And America really does have fairness mostly in mind. We keep the sea lanes open and we encourage the Europeans to get along instead of blowing each other up for a change. And isn't America's global hegemony a bit more benevolent than the average empire, Sheldon?
Well, I just saw an article by a libertarian being distributed now that says our intervention has been humanitarian and altruistic and has not been for any kind of, you know, economic self-interest or political self-interest, which I think is ridiculous. No, if you look at the record, it doesn't exactly live up to this image that you are citing here. I know you don't adopt it yourself, but it's you know, we ignore brutality. Heck, we support brutality when it serves the U.S. government's political, you know, geopolitical and economic interests, including its interests of its cronies. So we don't mind overlooking the Egyptian government military, which, number one, stages a coup and overthrows an elected government, and then mows down 1,400 people in the street. We look the other way when Israel has its periodic onslaughts against the Lebanese and the Palestinians, and their presidents could do something that would be perfectly libertarian. Withdraw the aid. Stop the aid. But does it do it? No, it does not. It keeps supporting them, which means it is an agent. It is an accomplice in those crimes. And so the world sees this selective indignation. It may fool Americans, but it doesn't fool anybody else. We wring our hands and cry our crocodile tears when we happen to have other interests aligned with that particular case. But it has nothing to do with humanitarianism.
Yeah. You know, I heard a caller on C-SPAN yesterday desperately trying to just make up reasons. She couldn't hear any coming from her heroes in the Democratic Party that she could support, so she just started making up her own and really reaching back to the bottom of the barrel to the Free Republic scribblings from 2002 about how, well, if we don't stop the chemical weapons over there, then they'll come over here. And I guess, you know, we're talking about just an average, you can tell, she's just an average American Obama supporter trying to come up with a reason for this war, and it must be that I guess Assad is going to attack us with chemical weapons if we don't attack him. There's got to be a post hoc reason that's good enough, Sheldon. There's just got to.
Well, yeah, if you keep looking, you'll find one. And I think in the next few days we're going to see Obama on TV in our face all the time selling this, because he's got to sell it. I mean, people are telling him he's got to get on TV and sell this to the American people, because when the polls, or what was it, just the Washington Post poll this morning said, what was it, 59% are against this, Obama's going to have to get to work. And that's what that's what the hawks are telling him. You got to get to work. It's not enough to give one speech in the Rose Garden. Now, unfortunately for him and the hawks, he's out of the country right now, so his hands are tied. He's busy with meetings and stuff like that, so maybe he won't be able to do that, thank goodness. Anyway, I was a little cheered yesterday when Curry in the Senate told Rand Paul, we're not asking for a declaration of war. So it seems to me the members of the Senate should have said, the panel, you know, the committee should have said, well, then you have no business here. We're going home. See you. I mean, if he's not there to ask for a declaration of war, what's he there for?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was what one of our previous guests was speculating about. What if Congress says no, or what if one of the houses of Congress says no? What's the president going to do then? Is he really going to go ahead anyway? Or
well,
he'll have to back down then, right?
I thought that was Rand Paul's great moment yesterday in tangling with Kerry. He said to him, unless you can tell us now that this vote is binding, this vote will be binding on you guys, even if it's a no. He said, look, you're probably going to win this. I mean, Rand Paul conceded that the House and Senate are probably going to vote for this. But he said, unless you tell us right now that this is a binding vote, then this is theater. What are we doing this for? And Curry just wiggled out of it and said, well, we're not contemplating that. We're going to win the vote, and it's not theater. And, you know, I wish Rand had gone after him a little harder, but he did fine. And, but the Secretary of State's always going to be able to, you know, wiggle off that hook. They have not given a very good explanation to the American people. I hope there'll be a way to get Gareth Porter's point, and you know, other people have cast doubt on all this so-called evidence. I hope there's a way to get that to the American people. Although I tried to insist in this op-ed that you just referenced of mine that came out today, that the case against intervention does not hinge on whether there was an actual chemical attack by Assad. We can grant that he used sarin gas on civilians in the eastern suburbs of Damascus, and it was ruthless and terrible and monstrous. We could grant that for the sake of argument. That only proves that he's a thug. It doesn't prove that we should intervene. That's a separate issue altogether. So we should debunk that, sure, because we need to know when the government's lying to us, because that's a full-time job. But that doesn't mean that the case against intervention stands if it turns out they're right in a given case.
Well, you know what? In this case, let's just say for the sake of argument here, and obviously I'm for the abolition of the U.S. government in its entirety, so I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I don't mean to be like Richard Wolff when he says, let's just put aside the evidence for a minute and argue based on my fantasy about why we got to do this. But no, let's argue for devil's advocate point of view here, and maybe make it absurd, okay? How about this? And this isn't that absurd. Let's say that at least to the satisfaction of the average Sunni Arab in Syria, it is a proven fact that Assad did it, and that's it. They've had it. They're willing now to leave home and go join up the Jabhat al-Nusra suicide bomber brigades and try to take down Bashar al-Assad. And now let's say Assad's response to that is to use every last drop of chemical weapons he has to kill as many Sunni Arab fighting age males and whoever happens to be nearby them as he can. And it really does turn into a massive chemical weapons genocide, basically, against Sunni Arabs inside Syria. Is there no point at which Sheldon Richman says that, look, the U.S. government is the only one able, and somebody's got to bomb this guy till he stops this? You can't just sarin gas hundreds of thousands of people. Now, again, in case you're just tuning in, I'm making this up. It's a hypothetical situation. But I'm just saying, where's the line, Sheldon, where actually somebody does need to intervene?
It's not our fight. The U.S. has no authority, even in international law, but no authority in internal law or constitutional law, to be the policeman of the world. It just does not have that, and we must not let it play that role, because it won't be confined only to the, you know, the rarefied case you can come up with hypothetically. It'll do plenty of other things that you wouldn't want it to do. It'll kill innocent people, and, you know, we can call that collateral damage, but, you know, as a friend of mine points out, if we're on the receiving end of collateral damage, we don't just shrug it off as collateral damage, do we? So we have to apply the same standard to us as to them. So no, the U.S. government has no legal or moral authority to play role police.
Well, you know, somebody pointed out to me on Twitter the other day about how there's so little discussion of possible collateral damage from American airstrikes, as though after all this, somebody, all of us, believe that airstrikes are these pinprick surgical type scalpel sort of instruments that only kill high level bad guy government employees.
Right. No, that's right. And I, you know, I'm getting sick of this phrase boots on the ground or no boots on the ground, because the way that's used now is to say, hey, there's nothing wrong here, where there's no risk. It's fine. No boots on the ground. It's like a magic word. You tell the American people, and it's like, okay, then do whatever the heck you want, as long as no boots on the ground. You know, I imagine an Onion headline where I had Obama issuing Nike shoes to the troops so he could truthfully say there'll be no boots on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, this is ridiculous.
Or just dropping H-bombs on them. See? No boots.
Exactly.
No Americans
look,
killed.
I would rather they just take, you know, fly over and drop a lot of boots. Okay, if they want to only do that, I'll go for that. That they can do. Just drop boots.
That's funny. Yeah, wouldn't that be great if that's what the Navy was for, like in the public relations, to just go around helping people when there's a flood or something? That would be hilarious.
We have to break this mindset that the U.S. is, you know, look, there's a lot of, you had this horrible nightmare scenario, the hypothetical you just came up with. There's bad stuff going on in a lot of places. The Congo has been a hellhole. There was all these other places. I mean, terrible things go on. We're very selective. The U.S. government's very selective. And it's very cynical. And this, we should not let the, we cannot let the government get away with this pose that it's this humanitarian, you know, first responder, or maybe not first, but eventual responder, and it only has humanitarianism at heart. We have to strip that bare. It sponsors atrocities, as I say in the article. Whenever a government represses its own population, chances are it's using equipment labeled "Made in the USA."
Right. Yeah, and you know, as Pat Buchanan has pointed out, I think he raised a couple of hypotheticals, like, "Oh yeah, well, what if the Chinese go to crush Mongolian independence? And what if the what if a hardcore regime rises to power after Putin in Russia? People think he's bad. It could be a lot worse. And what if they reinvade Eastern Europe? Are we really going to give up the United States of America in a fight with Russia over Eastern Europe? No, we're not. I mean, depending, I guess, on how much of a maniac the president is at any given time. But, you know, drawing the line at Germany was tough enough back during the Cold War. But, yeah, we will, we being the U.S. government and its policymakers, will tolerate and, of course, in some cases, encourage and be, in other cases, directly responsible for mass death all over the world. And if the Russians reinvaded Estonia and whatever, that would be really sad. But it would also be tough for them.
Well, and we can do our part to make sure things like that don't happen. And I'm not saying that's a perfect solution, but let's not threaten Russia. Let's not bring NATO up to their doorstep. Let's not keep acting as if the Cold War was on. We keep saying, oh, well, the Cold War's over. The U.S. didn't behave like the Cold War was over back in 91. They were encircling Russia and digging it in and doing their zone, you know, their end zone dance and spiking the ball. They never stopped doing it. That's one reason. One reason we're going after Assad is Russia. The other reason is Iran. We don't want Russia to have any ally in the Middle East because that challenges the U.S./Israel hegemony. And of course, we don't want Iran to be anything but a compliant sock puppet, as you'd like to say, for the same reason. And, that's one reason. Look, Assad was a good friend of ours not that long ago when we sent him people to be tortured. We outsourced torture to him, and he was our friend then. But, you know, he's getting the Saddam Hussein and the Gaddafi treatment now.
Right.
He's outlived his usefulness for us.
In fact, his father was even welcome to help America war against Saddam Hussein back in the first Gulf War in 91.
Yeah, and his father kept the peace with Israel. The Golan Heights have been quiet for, over 40 years? I'm not sure Israel... Israel might want chaos in Syria. I'm not sure they want Assad overthrown.
Yeah, well, that's my question. What the hell? I don't understand. I really don't. When the Assads, from the Israeli point of view, they're not perfect, obviously, whatever, but still... Like you just said, they've been keeping the peace for generations there now. Why in the world, how in the world could Israel think that they're better off with a smashed warring nation state of suicide bombers and ethnic cleansers running around there for the medium term, if not indefinite future, you know?
I guess they've made a calculus that it's better to cause headaches for Iran's ally and Hezbollah's ally than to... have things remain, status quo. That's a guess on my part, but I don't pretend to know what's going on in Netanyahu's mind.
Yeah. Well, now, when it comes to American domestic politics, I saw a story that said Raytheon stock is doing real good. I guess they do the cruise missiles and some of the drones and stuff. Obviously, there are stories, many, many stories, more than could be expected, I think, more than I would have expected, about the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee and their allies up on Capitol Hill lobbying for this thing. But you know what? I saw a thing this morning. It's on antiwar.com this morning where the chief of the Air Force is, he's kind of crabbing about his sequester cuts, but he's also saying... Well, we're not really ready to do this. This is going to be a lot harder than Libya was. And, geez, I don't know. I take that as a shot across Obama's bow that even the head of the Air Force doesn't want to do this. And I'm thinking that's shocking to me because if this was 3, 4, or 5 years ago and we were talking about the threat of war with Iran, the theory was that the Air Force was, this was Gareth Porter's thinking on it, was that the Air Force was the only part of the military that was happy to go ahead and do it. The Marines and the Army sure as hell didn't want to. They would have to clean up the mess, you know, or try to, that kind of thing. But here in this case, in Syria, apparently the Air Force doesn't even want to do it. And I was just wondering, can you tell, is there anyone that you know of in America, any organized faction that wants to do this other than the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee at AIPAC.org?
Yeah, which the White House, some White House spokesman referred to as the 800-pound gorilla in this matter, heavily lobbying Congress to give Obama what he wants. I mean, they would like to go much further, not just have some, you know, limited two-day strike, but actually regime change, I suppose. Thankfully, the military seems reluctant. I read that the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dempsey, kind of undercut Kerry, sitting right next to him in that Senate hearing. Kerry threw the ball to him a couple times, and he didn't exactly pick it up and run with it, like about what would be the consequence of a U.S. strike. Kerry wants to be able to say, oh, and we know absolutely this will only have good effect and will stop Assad from doing this again, and he didn't get the backup he expected to get from Dempsey. So maybe the military really doesn't want to do this. That would be good news.
Well, you know, they're doing another one of these things in front of the House right now. Thankfully, I've left the closed caption off. But yesterday, it was really something else watching the expert witnesses, Kerry, Dempsey, and Hagel, and the senators as well, all trying to dance around who the opposition is, and how if you attack the government, you're pretty much de facto fighting on the side of its opposition at that point in this war going on over there. I don't know if you can really call it a civil war or just a bunch of foreign mercenaries at war or whatever it is, but boy, I mean, they were even talking about, as we talked about with our previous guest, boots on the ground came up in the context of, well, geez, if our strikes are too effective and the regime is unable to keep the rebel jihadist suicide bomber types away from the chemical weapons, that's when we might have to put boots on the ground, would be to keep our rebel friends away from the chemical weapons. Because, geez, if these guys are willing to do suicide attacks, what might they be willing to do with some sarin?
Well, you'll notice that Curry, early in the hearing, said he didn't want anything taken off the menu, including boots. And then he had to backtrack and said, well, I was just answering a hypothetical. And, you know, we will accept language in the resolution that there won't be troops. But he earlier on said the president does not want to be limited. And that's the logic of it. You're right. What if that does happen? You know, that's the whole fallacy of this. Oh, we can do a limited strike in 1 or 2 days, because you never. It's a chess game. You've forgotten something. There's an opponent who's capable of making moves. They always act like there's no opponent.
Right.
We just can move any way we want, and that's the end of it. We decide when it's over.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, the people keep making, like the head of the Air Force making the comparison to Libya. Make the comparison to Libya, even if this was Libya, which means much simpler, much easier, much smaller army to fight, much more east versus west kind of progress that could be made on a simple risk map or whatever. Very cookie cutter war compared to the complicated mess going on in Syria. And meanwhile, it was an absolute disaster, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying compared to Syria is pretty cut and dry. And
they lost an ambassador and 3 other people.
Well, yeah, there was that, and then the war spreading to Mali, and of course the massive racial pogroms of the Arabs against the blacks.
Look, they're talking about the Balkans, but there's still European Union or NATO troops in Bosnia and Kosovo.
Right, yeah, keeping the sides
troops,
apart.
They're not American troops, so they don't count.
Right. But yeah, I mean, in the Libya thing, too, it was it's that slippery slope. It's so obvious to begin with. I mean, we talked about on this show, probably you and me talked about on this show, when they were still dithering I guess, as they call it, and deciding what the hell they were going to try to do there, but they were, you know, leaking trial balloons about no-fly zones. It was so obvious, the logic, that once you make a no-fly zone, you're taking responsibility for the civilian population of Libya under the claim that he's going to kill them all, of course, which was what they claimed. Oh, he's going to kill every last man, woman, and child and breathing little baby in all of Benghazi if we don't stop him. And then, so once they take the responsibility of the no-fly zone, they ultimately are taking responsibility for regime change. You know, same thing as Iraq, only in fast forward. But the premise being that the people aren't safe from their own government, and it's our, we're their government now, we're their security force now, and so we have to supplant him. The logic is inexorable, as they like to say on Fox News. So once you start doing pinprick strikes, once you start, you know, saying that our explosions must determine the behavior of the dictator there in his war, you're taking responsibility for the outcome of the war at that point.
Right. Look, they either live in a fantasy land, the policymakers, or they take us for morons. So you can decide which is the more realistic scenario.
I think
they
it's think a little
we're
both.
Not gonna, they assume we're not going to think of any of this, or the average person's not going to think of any of this. And, you know, maybe the average person isn't tracing it out.
It's well, yeah, I mean, and John Kerry said, yeah, we've had enough talk of the armchair isolationists. In other words, you either work in the State Department or shut up. This doesn't concern you.
Right, and of course they throw around that word isolationism. And, that, you know, as Joe Schoberner once somebody said, it's, you know, somebody who's against bombing other people is an isolationist.
Yeah, somebody who doesn't burn down their next-door neighbor's house is a hermit.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't matter that you want to trade and, you know, have freedom of movement and capital moving across national boundaries and economic exchange, but you're an isolationist because you don't want to drop your bombs on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, to conclude here, would you talk a little bit about how you end your article about the morality of the United States, who we are and what we do and what we believe in about ourselves and all these things and how it all just gets sullied we embrace this dishonesty and violence?
Well, I tried to point out that we can't live up to the values we claim to hold and be the world's policeman. We can't do both things because when we've already talked about the, you know, collateral damage, the killing of innocents that inevitably will happen if we're attempting to, you know, get involved in situations like this. But at home, of course, we also create havoc because, number one, there's the possibility of retaliation, terrorism, and then that's used to spy on us because we have to be spied on to be protected against the enemies the government created. So it sets in motion a whole bizarre set of negative consequences that are inconsistent with our values.
There you go. That's the great Sheldon Richman, Vice President of the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Thanks, Sheldon.
Thank you, Scott.
We must not be the world's policemen. See y'all tomorrow.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at ModernTimesMagazine.com.
Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016, FDR, no longer the worst president in American history, the National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952, and USA. Sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.